Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Hope you had a very nice Father's Day. If your father is still with us in the world, you had a chance to pay tribute to him, or if you're a dad yourself, hope was a very special day. It was a very nice one for me. Began by reading Jervy Tervelon, who's a regular listener to our program, calls in a novelist and writer in Altadena, with a beautiful remembrance of his father that was in yesterday's Los Angeles Times. Just a beautiful piece by Jervy. If you didn't get a chance to read it, I highly recommend it. Just a great tribute of a son for his father. We begin with politics, and later this hour, we'll have the latest on COVID-19 with our daily update from a noted medical authority. But we begin in our politics coverage with former National Security Advisor John Bolton, his book, which is highly critical of President Trump. John Bolton talked with ABC News yesterday about his book, which paints a highly unflattering portrait of the president.
Well, I think he was so focused on the reelection longer-term considerations fell by the wayside. So if he thought he could get a photo opportunity with Kim Jong-un at the demilitarized zone in Korea, there was considerable emphasis on the photo opportunity and the press reaction to it. And little or no focus on what such meetings did for the bargaining position of the United States.
Joining us to talk politics is Pepperdine University Senior Fellow in the School of Public Policy, Elizabeth Spaulding, and also joining us from UCLA, Professor of Political Science and Chicano Studies, Matt Barreto, who's also the co-founder of the research and polling firm Latino Decisions. Professors, very good to have you with us. Elizabeth Spaulding, let me start with you and your response to John Bolton's book and what potential effect this has on the campaign.
Hi, Larry. Good to be with you. Greetings from Washington, D.C., where we are now in phase two, and happy to have made it that far.
Very good.
On Bolton's book, this is definitely the story that people are currently talking about in Washington. And what's not clear is if it will end up being more of what we call an inside the Beltway story in the end. In addition to the clip that you played, it's also already well known by this point that Bolton is accusing Trump of Ukraine-type behavior toward China. And so that's something that, you know, there would be political repercussions about perhaps. But what's really clear in reading the extended excerpts of the book is that are available so far is that Bolton really does not agree with Trump on foreign policy issues. And he presents himself as always correct and Trump as always wrong. And something that's actually uniting people across the political spectrum is a wariness about Bolton, since he wouldn't testify during the House impeachment hearings.
Also with us, Matt Barreto, as I mentioned. Matt, thank you for joining us. And your thoughts about the impact of the Bolton book.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this has been a story since the impeachment, because it was known that Bolton had questions of Trump. And so now that the book is out and has been cleared to come out, I think we're going to start getting a lot more answers to that behind-the-scenes look of how things were playing out. I think this just contributes to other accounts we have heard from former staff members, high-level, low-level, in between, and just adds to that sort of sense that Trump is really only concerned about his own image, his ego. That's nothing new. That has already been well known, of course. But it contributes to that, and it just keeps that sort of story going, that Trump is really in all of these meetings for his own good, for his own image, and certainly not perhaps in it for the best of the country, which many of his advisors have been pushing. So nothing groundbreaking, I don't think, is in there, at least from what we've heard so far, but just continues to that negative image of Trump.
Well, and you have, of course, the two parties viewing this very differently. Republicans, you seeing this as being disloyal to the president, and you've got Democrats who are saying, well, why didn't he speak before the impeachment hearing? Why didn't he come public with this before doing this in his book? And Matt, do you think that the reasons that he's given for how he's gone public with this are defensible?
Well, I think, you know, certainly he was trying to sell a book. Let's not forget that. This happens with lots of former administrative appointments, both from Democrats and Republicans. They want to talk about their experiences. You know, he probably has been working on this for quite a while and knew that. And so that's certainly a fact that can't be ignored. And he is, of course, motivated by his own sort of personal interest in this as well. But everything that is coming out is going to be viewed between now and Election Day through a very sharp partisan lens. Aside from Senator Romney, there have been almost no defections from President Trump within those currently elected or appointed Republicans. And I would expect that to continue. And expect to see Democrats continue to criticize everything in this lead up to the election. So the Bolton story really fits into that model, and I think we're just going to continue seeing more of that through now and Election Day. A big story will be when something like Senator Romney happens, where high-ranking Republicans do choose to publicly spar or distance themselves from the president. So far, that hasn't happened.
Elizabeth, do you think this moves the needle at all with those who might be on the fence about voting for the president in November?
I don't think it will move the needle at all. And I actually think one of the biggest political implications may be for presidents themselves from this, because traditionally those who work for the president wait until after the administration to publish their critiques. That's not a hard and fast rule. But Bolton has certainly broken this in a huge way. And in light of that, and then the kind of news and social media world we live in now, I think presidents will be likelier to keep their inner circle very close and ever smaller, be even more cautious about what they say in private meetings with other advisors, and go from there. So I don't know. I think everybody already thinks what they think about Trump, and I think Matt has it right about what it's going to look like for the next almost 4.5 months.
We're talking with Pepperdine University senior fellow at the School of Public Policy, Elizabeth Spaulding, and Professor Matt Barreto of UCLA, co-founder of Latino Decisions. Just late Friday night, we had what was sort of a stare down in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, where Attorney General William Barr had said that Jeffrey Berman, the Manhattan U.S. attorney, prosecutor, was looking into associates of President Trump and Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani, had been removed from his position. Berman said that he was not going until a successor was confirmed. And then we had a report that the president over the weekend fired him and Berman left the office. Matt Barreto, what is the response of Republicans to this? Is there concern specifically because of the kinds of investigations that Mr. Berman was undertaking?
Yeah, I think this is actually the potential to be a bigger story as more details come out. It sounds like Barr might have even, you know, tried to offer him another job to step out. And really sort of, again, this is consistent with what we've seen before, going all the way back to Jeff Sessions' recusal, that the president and his team are not happy with people who are investigating them. This really gets the fundamental sort of rule of law and democratic norms. And so Berman had been investigating in the Southern District of New York many associates of Trump and had a lot of power, was a very politically powerful person. And so this whole fiasco of who fired him, did he actually get fired? Did the president have to weigh in? You even had Senator Lindsey Graham weighing in and say, wait a minute, this is something the president officially has to sign off on. So I'm looking forward to seeing more details of this come out. I don't know if Berman will say anything now that he has agreed to step aside. Certainly they wanted to get a successor in place so that that office was not rudderless. That was a bit of what you heard being described, is that there was a move to just take the person out and there would be no acting director in this division, which could be quite detrimental to their efforts. So I think this has a little bit more legs, and we'll be interested to see what happens in the follow-up.
Elizabeth Spaulding, some of the reporting that I've seen, that there are Republican leaders who are concerned that Attorney General Barr is inviting too much scrutiny by him doing this, along with other actions that he has taken over the past year. Then do you think that that's justified concern, that Barr is putting himself into a position where he's just going to get more and more criticized for the political dimension of his job?
Right. I think that some Republicans are way, but other Republicans, and then those who are more on the conservative side, are still very much in favor of what Barr's trying to do, and have responded with comments along the lines of the Manhattan U.S. attorney works for the attorney general, who in turn is under the president. I've also heard a couple of people talking about how Berman was originally an interim U.S. attorney who would stay until the vacancy was filled. So these sorts of people on the right don't see anything odd here necessarily, and have pointed out that nothing has been raised that suggests that this personnel change will, you know, head off a particular case or investigation at this point. I agree with Matt that we have to get more details. You know, this is a very much still a breaking story. And then maybe, and I've heard this too from some people, more seems to be that another person, more going on here seems to be that another person is interested in that job. So the current Securities and Exchange Commission chairman, Jay Clayton, is planning apparently to leave the administration and move back to New York. And then
And he doesn't have, he's never been a prosecutor, has he?
No. So that would be, I mean, then you get into some of the questions we get into with the Trump administration about how well prepared certain people are for the jobs that they end up getting. I'm not sure where this will go. And to go back to one of Matt's points, and I think maybe yours too. Anyway, Senator Lindsey Graham has already said that he's going to defer to the home senators from New York on the appointment. When he says something like that, he really means it.
What, compare and contrast, if you would, Barr to previous attorney generals in the Obama administration. We have Eric Holder, Loretta Lynch, because Democrats have said that Barr is much more nakedly a political operative of the president. Do you think that's true?
I think it depends on where you're coming from. So if you are somebody who is liberal or progressive, absolutely. If you're somebody who is Republican, and then if you're conservative, if you're somebody who's been involved in organizations like the Federalist Society, then you think that this is a good pick for Attorney General, somebody who is actually in favor of the rule of law. And I think that it's hard when it's I think some of this is Barr is in Trump's administration. If he were again attorney general like he had been or under a different president, you know, if you look at the past, a lot of the criticisms about Barr have become much more pronounced now while he's working in the particular administration he's in.
Yeah, Matt Beretta, what do you think? Is the way that Barr is conducting the AG's job significantly different than his predecessors in the Obama administration?
Yeah, I think you are starting to see some difference here. And the difference is whether or not these positions, which are ostensibly supposed to oversee an independent Department of Justice, are really just sort of hatchet men, essentially, for whoever is in power. You know, we could turn the question and say, would some of those same conservatives who really are excited about Barr protecting the president want to see the same sort of principles applied if it was a President Obama or a President Biden? Do you want the person in charge of the Department of Justice weighing in and dismissing people who are looking into issues within an administration? Certainly, you know, we want to have that independence in our Department of Justice, regardless of which party is in power. And if they are allegations that lead nowhere, then that's what the investigation will turn up. And so I think we have crossed into this line really from the outset with Trump announcing, you know, his displeasure with Sessions for not recusing himself and making that initial investigation go away, that there has been then a line. It's certainly that when Barr was being interviewed for this, these were the types of questions put to him. Certainly when Kavanaugh was considered for the court, his strong support of executive authority was a prime consideration for Trump. So I think you're seeing that it fits with the rest of his profile. And that is a move away from where we had been under the Bush or Obama administrations.
We're talking with Matt Barreto, UCLA professor of political science and Chicano studies, co-founder of the research and polling firm Latino Decisions, and from Pepperdine University School of Public Policy, senior fellow Elizabeth Spaulding, joining us from Washington, D.C. President Trump spoke at his first re-election campaign rally in Tulsa on Saturday night, and it was a much smaller crowd than Trump's organizers had touted.
Last week, retail sales numbers came in. Retail sales, the single greatest number in the history of our country. So here's what's going to happen. Here's what's going to happen. They blame a president for anything. When you see looters, even though we put them down, if we didn't stop them, nobody would, because the other side will never stop them. But they always blame a president. Here's what's happening. We're going up, we're going up, we're going up, we're going to go up. Then we're going to hit October. We're going to be up. We're going to be way up. We're not going to be where we were, but in many ways, other than all of the horrible, horrible death that was so needlessly caused by a virus that should have been stopped where it originated, which was China.
So in 55 seconds, President Trump, touching on a number of the themes that are central to his reelection campaign. Matt Barreto, first of all, let's talk about the themes and then the small size of the crowd. But any surprises in the president's nearly hour and a half talk?
Well, I think the biggest surprise is the one that's been getting most of the attention, both in the mainstream news and social media, which is that the president publicly announcing that he had advised people to do less testing or to slow down testing. It's consistent with all of his other public remarks that he doesn't like testing because testing leads to identifying results of coronavirus cases. And so that was most certainly off script, but revealed a bit of the president's struggles with this. This is a pandemic that not only has health but economic impacts. And the president likes, you know, good numbers. He likes to brag about good numbers. And so the testing numbers certainly aren't good. So I think you're going to see more of that. I think you're going to see more pushing of what did the president do from the outset to get the country prepared for this virus that was coming our way, whether we liked it or not. And what is the president doing now here just on the health aspects to keep our country prepared, to allow our country to reopen safely, and listening to health experts. So that bit about testing was, I think, one of the things that caught my ear.
So you didn't take that as a tongue-in-cheek remark. You took that he was serious when he said that.
I mean, it's consistent with all of the other remarks he has given, which he has said before from the White House. He wished that there was less testing because the testing just reveals more cases. So I wouldn't at all be surprised if behind the scenes he told people, like, let's not do as much testing so that we can get some better numbers. He's always talking about better numbers, whether it's the economy, the coronavirus, et cetera. So I think it revealed a bit of, you know, his intentions, which are consistent with his public comments on that.
And, of course, this was an indoor event in, I think it was 19,000-seat arena, although there were a lot of empty seats in the upper level, but people close together in the lower part of the arena. Elizabeth Spaulding, what stood out for you most in the president's talk?
What stood out to me was that it really was a campaign rally, that he is ready to get back in there, and he was hoping that it would be like one of his rallies of old. So the themes that came out to me were really significant. He really is going to use Make America Great Again, Keep America Great. That was a big one. He's invoking this silent majority theme. And for Americans of a certain age, they've lived through that before, so they've heard it. And Trump seems to think that it'll be something that appeals to his base and maybe win him some more people. He also emphasized law and order, which, again, seems very central to his reelection campaign at this moment, along with the economy, you know, that he is trying to say is still so strong and will come back after the pandemic or during the latter part, whatever this stage of coronavirus that we're in. And I think that Trump showed that he is doubling down on what he thinks will buoy his base And then he hopes he will find more supporters among a silent majority. And that remains to be seen, of course. But he was very careful in the 101 minutes. I didn't watch it all. He was very careful, though, to distinguish between what he sees as peaceful protests going on and then contrasting that with the violent rioters and looters.
We'll talk about the small size of the crowd and talk about what that bodes for the campaign. Particularly, much of the president's base are older Americans. Are they going to come out for indoor events to rally around the president, or are these the kinds of crowd sizes he's going to be getting as he continues the events? We're talking with Pepperdine's Elizabeth Spaulding, UCLA's Matt Barreto. We'll continue with our political analysts. We'll also talk about the competing legislation on police reform in Congress. Much more to come on Air Talk in just 1 minute. Coming up, our daily COVID-19 update. We're going to be talking with UCLA professor Dr. David Eisenman, who's public health specialist as well, and he directs the university's Center for Public Health and Disaster. Speaking of UCLA, Professor Matt Barreto is with us, and Pepperdine University School of Public Policy senior fellow Elizabeth Spaulding with us as well. Matt, I can't make any sense of the fact that the Trump campaign touted what an enormous crowd was going to come out and the overflow area outside the arena in Tulsa they were going to need for the president to address the throngs who would be coming out. Building up that sort of an expectation, if they really expected that, why wouldn't they let that appear as pent-up demand as opposed to setting such a high expectation and potentially, you know, turning people away who wouldn't have wanted to come out to a huge crowd?
Yeah, I think there was a couple of missteps here on the campaign front. The first was not seeing the sort of prank that was played on them by these people who were registering tickets. When they announced that they had over 1 million people interested, that should have set off some alarm bells. Tulsa City only has a population of 400,000 people. So right there, they should have been a little bit looking into what might be happening. But they wanted a big number again, consistent with what we were talking about before. Trump loves to brag about these crowd sizes. And then they started planning this overflow arena where they were going to put up big jumbotrons and have the president possibly make an appearance. And you probably saw some of the outside shots of that there's no more than a handful of people, maybe two dozen, 20, 30 people out there standing in the overflow area. So I think it was just they were excited for this event. There hasn't been a rally in a long time. Certainly in 2015 and 16, this was Trump's strong point, was the rally atmosphere. And I think they were really excited for that, and they didn't pay enough attention to the details. And it was a combination of people registering who had no intention to go, and then other people who might have registered and thought, I don't think I'm going to go sit in this closed-door arena right next to somebody else, not wearing a mask, et cetera. So I think there were a lot of missteps there, and they're going to have to really tighten up how they move forward for these rallies.
Well, yeah, and how are they going to get crowds in the future? Because the president has relied on the energy of the live crowd. I mean, those that were there were obviously very enthusiastic, Elizabeth Spaulding, but it seems he almost has to, in his next campaign rally, get a very large crowd to turn out.
I think he's going to, his campaign's already working on that. They'll work very hard for that. And they'll look at this Tulsa rally as a snapshot of what the campaign looks like at this point in June, the first big campaign event during a COVID-19 reopening. The Trump campaign was very much hoping for a reset with this rally, and they didn't get it. So I don't know if we're going to get a lot of discussion about that publicly, but I'm sure that that's what they're talking about inside the campaign. And we know that, you know, Trump likes things to look good. So I'm sure he has weighed in about that to his people. But I'm not sure what this means going forward, because it is all in the time of coronavirus. And, you know, over 120 some thousand dead, over 2.3 million cases. even though scientists and researchers are figuring out more as we speak about the virus, we still don't know what's ahead and if there will be wavelets or a second wave. Obviously, we're seeing different data in different states now, and a lot of those are states that Trump wants to go to and have big rallies in. And he wants to show that he's vibrant and exciting and different from Biden. Think about the tag he gives to Biden, Sleepy Joe. And so he is seeing that the optics so far for Biden's campaign events are not what he thinks Trump thinks will attract people. So he wants to do something big. He wants to do something exciting. I don't know if he's going to try one more, two more. I'm really not sure on this. I think he'll want to do another big rally.
But it's clearly a huge challenge. Speaking of Joe Biden, Senator Amy Klobuchar withdrew herself from VP consideration. She might well have seen the writing on the wall that in this time of the Black Lives Matter movement and her record from her time as a prosecutor, that was not going to make her the likely running mate to Joe Biden. She called for a woman of color to be chosen for that position. Just briefly, Elizabeth, your thoughts about who would appear to be best positioned for that role now?
Right. I think that most everyone's current list has Senator Kamala Harris up very high. And if it's going to be a woman of color, then that means that Senator Elizabeth Warren drops. And so most likely the two that most benefit from what's been going on, especially if I think probably Klobuchar was getting some signaling during the vetting process about where the Biden campaign wants to go. I think it's probably Harris and Florida Representative Val Demings, and not so much on the latter point for Demings because of, I mean, she's, you know, a rising star, but she...
Former police chief.
She brings Florida to the mix, where Harris, of course, brings California. And that brings us kind of backwards into, you know, usually you say of a VP choice, first, do no harm. Second, pick someone who could step into the president's shoes. Look for geographic diversity or bringing a home state's electoral count. And I think that that's part of the reason that Harris's prospects are strengthened at this point. In addition to everything else, she also has national legislative experience.
Of course, I mean, the flip side is for California. Joe Biden is going to win California in a runaway over the president in November. So, you know, those electoral votes are not at issue. But certainly as a senator having a very prominent position, you know, Kamala Harris has that to her credit as well. Matt, what do you think as you handicap the likely running mates for Joe Biden?
I think those are the ones at the top, you know, Senator Harris, Representative Deming. I think you also have Stacey Abrams sort of as the outsider looking in as a possible person in the mix. And I do think that an African-American woman is a smart choice for Biden. I think it not only adds gender and racial diversity, but adds those additional perspectives and will also be able to do outreach into diverse communities. So it would seem to be a strong pick. I do think that that means that someone like Senator Warren, who is becoming a very strong contender, probably is setting herself up for a key cabinet post if Biden were to win. And it might be smart of him to announce that someone like Senator Warren, who is extremely popular with progressives, would still find a role in his administration. I think that could curry a lot of favor with those voters as well. But those are the candidates, I think, the contenders that people are looking at. Harris does have the advantage. You mentioned, you know, California, not a swing state, but has been vetted because she did appear in many of the debates, has been on the campaign trail, and so does have that experience and ability to participate in a national campaign, which is quite grueling and quite difficult, even amidst these, you know, digital campaign events now. There's still a lot of work involved in that, and I think Harris has demonstrated that. So she's probably at the top of the list.
Matt, I also wanted to ask you about, we have two different policing reform measures. Democrats, with their bill in the House, they also have essentially the same bill in the Senate, but Democrats, they're the minority, of course, and Republican senators have their bill in the Senate. What do you think are the prospects of some sort of a compromise or successful bill that comes out of Congress?
Well, my hopes are not good. This has been a difficult time for Congress to compromise on anything. Of course, we've had awful instances of shootings at schools, and that never led to any real reform. So it's difficult for this Congress to compromise on these issues. I would put police reform up there, as conservatives are very, very strong supporters of almost writing a blank check to police, as you've heard people like Jeff Sessions talk about. So I don't think there's a huge prospect, especially during a campaign year. But the images that are coming out and the stories that are coming out almost weekly now of new evidence, even after the George Floyd protests, I think is adding significant fuel to the fire that there has to be some sort of reform. So my hope is that those leaders in the Senate, which is where the compromise needs to take place, get together and see if there is something that can start that process perhaps this summer.
Elizabeth Spaulding, are you hopeful of some sort of an agreement that both parties could sign on to?
I think the optimist in me wants to say that this is Senator Tim Scott's moment. He's a Republican from South Carolina. And we want to remember that in various recent polls, 70-some percent of Americans support peaceful protests and 70-some percent say no to defunding the police. And then almost similarly high numbers want, or sometimes on certain polls, higher numbers say that the police need to continue to make changes to address unequal treatment of blacks and whites. All of those are very high percentages of agreement across political lines in polls. And I think the successful politicians and policymakers, both in Congress but everywhere, will want to build on that intersection of public opinion. So Matt's right, it may not happen before the election, but I think there's a moment here, and I hope it happens.
All right. I want to thank you both very much. That's Elizabeth Spaulding, Pepperdine School of Public Policy Senior Fellow, and Matt Barreto, Professor of Political Science and Chicano Studies at UCLA. He's co-founder of Latino Decisions, the research and polling firm. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up in our next hour, we'll talk about the statues that have been taken down either forcibly or through governmental decision across the country, and even the renaming of cities that are being considered, like Fort Bragg up on the Northern California coast that was named for a Confederate military leader. We'll talk about what's the best way to reassess or potentially remove or rename monuments or tributes to controversial historical figures. We have much more to come next on Air Talk, our daily update on COVID-19. We'll be back in 90 seconds.